Okay, so thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak. So let me start with a couple of apologies. So first of all, I must tell you from the very beginning that my understanding of the relevant physics is somehow more than limited. So there's a good chance that I'm going to say something totally wrong from a physical point of view. So just if you feel that that's the case, then please correct me. And another thing is that most of the things I'm going to talk about, they're not very new. I mean, but maybe about 2 years old, except for maybe the very last part about quantum groups, to which I probably won't have time to get anyway. And another thing is that somehow for me, one of the most important purposes of giving this talk in the Solitons is actually, so this talk is actually going to be completely mathematical, or almost completely mathematical, but somehow my primary interest would be for physicists to explain what actually I'm doing. So let me begin by formulating some conjecture, which in fact in the form I'm going to formulate it now is already a theorem. And this conjecture is really due to Nekrasov. So Nekrasov's conjecture, so this is some kind of, it is an absolutely rigorous conjecture, even if, as I said, in this particular formulation, it's even a theorem, but in a slightly more general context, it is still a conjecture, at least in some cases. And it has to do with, at least from my point of view, with trying to formulate rigorously some known physical results about, again, in this particular case, it will be n equals 2 four-dimensional pure gauge theory. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to fix, my notations will be the following. So I'm going to fix group K, which is compact and simply connected group. So you can think about SUN, but somehow the main point is that the story I'm going to tell you actually works for all groups, in particular for exceptional groups. Compact, simply connected. In fact, I will mostly be talking some kind of holomorphic language, so I also want to introduce G, which will be its complexification. So you can think about SUN here and SLNC here. So this conjecture is going to be about certain partition function, which I'm going to write down. And the partition function will be a generating function of certain integrals. So to write down those integrals, I will first of all have to explain to you what are the spaces over which we're integrating, and then what kind of integrals on those spaces we're considering. So first of all, spaces are the following. So let's fix some integer d greater or equal than 0. So in fact, I said that this group is simply connected. I also want to assume that it's simple, or its Lie algebra is simple. So again, SUN is a perfectly good example. Then I'm going to introduce the first approximation to the space I will need is the following space, which I'll denote by MDG. And this space somehow has the following two incarnations. So first of all, I mean, I guess physicists would just say that this is the space of this is the moduli space of instantons on R4 with instanton number D. So more mathematically, it says that you consider antisel dual, instanton K instantons. So you can see the principle K bundles with antisel dual connections, and D is the second Schrödinger class of that bundle. And in fact, somehow you have to consider it not on R4, but rather on, for example, four-dimensional sphere. And so you have to consider these things on the sphere with some additional structure at infinity. So there's also some purely holomorphic language which I'm sort of more used to, on which you can talk, using which you can talk about this space. So this is the same as a also moduli space of holomorphic G bundles. And here, as I said, So R4 should, I mean, if you do it rigorously, R4 should be actually replaced by sphere with some additional structure within at infinity. So unfortunately, sphere is not really complex manifold. So, but we need somehow, in, you know, instead of R4, holomorphic language, we'll think about it as C2, and we need to somehow compactify it as a complex manifold. So basically, you can take whatever compactification you like. So of course, the most natural one is just the projective plane. So we'll consider the holomorphic G bundles on CP2. Here I'll tell you precisely what is the additional structure plus trivialization of those bundles. Trivialization at infinity, and infinity here means this is just infinite CP1. CP2. See, this R4. So this is. So this is you know, this is a complex surface or a four-dimensional manifold. So Okay. So that is the space. Somehow it is known mathematically that these two spaces are the same, at least as topological spaces. So what I will need about the space is first of all some groups which are acting on them. No, they are equal, but just I said that these are two different ways how you can think about the spaces, and somehow I guess that physically this one is much more natural, but for me somehow this one is.
Do you have a direct map between these two prompts or the?
Well, the map is kind of depends what I mean by direct. So somehow you have to, I mean, direct means that you have to solve some partial differential equation. For example, to go from here to here, you have to solve some partial differential equation. And there's a theorem that there is a unique solution, but somehow...
But there's a point-by-point map.
Yes, this is a point-by-point. I mean, this is general some theorem. There's this general theorem of Uhlenbeck and Yao, which allows you to do this. So on any surface, on any complex surface, in fact, there is some generalization due to Simpson even to high-dimensional manifolds. So these are the spaces. Now, first of all, some remark is that there are some groups which are acting on those spaces, and which are crucial not to write this partition function of Nekrasov. Namely, so the group G acts on the space by changing the trivialization. I mean, the same. You would also have the same in this picture, but probably in this picture would naturally only have action of K. But this is perfectly fine for the purposes. For our purposes. And also the group GO2C. Trivialization, just identification. Just take your bundle, restrict it, and then identify it with a trivial bundle. Just fixed isomorphism with a trivial bundle. GL2 acts just because it acts on this thing, so it acts on P2 and preserves the line at infinity by acting on CP2. So this is just, maybe at this point it's just a remark, but this remark will be very important in a couple of minutes. Yes.
G means just the global page.
Yes, G means just more, you know, changing some kind of condition at infinity, so...
Rigid gauge.
Yes, exactly. And this is just automorphism of your space. This is one thing. Another thing we're going to need is some kind of partial complexification of this space. And it's actually some kind of... this story is not so easy, but... there is known partial complexification due to... which I guess in physics is called the space of ideal instantons. So some space which I'll denote by U, D, G, and so somehow you want to allow your instantons to degenerate at points. And this space is very easy to describe set theoretically, but not so easy to describe as an actual space. And set theoretically, it looks like a union of all D prime less or equal than D and greater or equal than zero. Oh, I guess I never said what D was. D was, of course, D is the second Schrodinger class. here you take the following thing. You take the same space with smaller d and multiply it by the corresponding symmetric power of C2. So basically, what is symmetric? What is an element of the symmetric power? It just means that it's basically a bunch of points on C2. So to specify a point here, we have to specify a bunch of points on our surface and in a, well, a complex surface. And in addition, we have to specify a bundle or an instanton of a smaller instanton number. And well, we have to somehow glue those pieces into one space. And this is, you know, topologically, this was actually done by Uhlenbeck. And in fact, this thing is also an algebraic variety. But somehow this is a much more complicated state. In fact, just for the mathematicians, this in fact is an affine algebraic variety.
In that language, how do you think of those points as some kind of sheaves?
No. It's complicated. If you want to describe this algebraically, this is, for example, I don't know how to do it on arbitrary surface. There's no algebraic definition of this for arbitrary surface. So, there will be probably soon, but I think Drinfeld is working very hard on this, but this somehow mathematically is a very serious problem, I think. There is some definition for G being SLN, but again, so maybe what I should say is that this is what Nekrasov is using in what he does in simplifications. He actually for G equals SLN, one can consider different compactification, which is really different. Namely, so if G is SLN, then there is another space which I'll call maybe GD. So this is called the Giesecke space, and this space is the space of torsion-free sheaves, modulus space of torsion-free coherent sheaves on, again, CP2, plus the same trivialization at infinity. Well, and when I say trivialization at infinity, so, if you know something about torsion-free sheaves, then somehow you know that torsion-free sheaves are things which again generically look like vector bundles, but torsion-free sheaves of generic rank n. So these are things which generically look like vector bundles of rank n, but at some points they have some singularities. And when I say trivialization at infinity, it means that first of all I don't allow the singularities to be at infinity, and then at infinity I actually do have an honest vector bundle, so I can trivialize. I mean, if it's trivializable, then I can. This is a different compactification. And in fact, it's known that there is a map. So this is, maybe I should call it just N. So there is just, this is SLN. There is a map like this, which is generically, of course, an isomorphism, and which is actually proper. So in fact, I should say that this space is singular always. Basically, I mean, in all non-trivial cases, this is a singular space. And the advantage of this space is that this space is non-singular. So somehow, this is why for SLN many things become much easier, because instead of doing computations here, you can do computations here. And somehow, sort of working with non-singular spaces for some purposes is much, much easier. But again, since I probably won't be able to tell you how the computations are done anyhow, then I'll just only give you the formulations, and the formulations I can give using this. No, in this case it's not complete because I fixed the trivialization to infinity. Somehow I don't allow degenerations at infinity, so this is why I get something which is not. You see, for example, if I didn't have this kind of structure, then for example here you already see something non-compact because somehow I have the C2 and not CP2, But somehow, if you don't have this realization, then you have to talk, you have to introduce some kind of stability conditions. I mean, see, the advantage of this thing is that these objects have no automorphism, so you don't have to worry about. So when I said moduli space, in general, moduli space is a complicated object. But here you don't have to worry about this. So it's really moduli space of these things. So it has the most natural moduli space in the easiest possible sense.
Is there a complete? Which gives an algebraic variety.
I mean some constructed by some nature in some natural way. I mean, of course, every algebraic variety has a. Especially this thing is affine, so I can somehow. But I don't think there is a. I don't know. No, but here, in fact, it's going to be very important that these things are not compact, because if these things were compact, then the integrals I'm going to introduce in a second would just be all trivial. So these are the spaces we're going to work with. Maybe I should say that this computation is kind of natural, and one of the incarnations of this fact is that these groups still act here. So G cross GL2 acts. So this is the spaces. Now let me talk a little bit about integrals in some very general context. So again, somehow, as far as I understand, this all comes from some kind of physical problem. And what you get from the physical problem is that you actually get some integrals over these spaces, over these non-compactified spaces. But in the objects which are integrating are just some honest differential forms. But somehow it's very hard to integrate differential forms, and you want to interpret that in some kind of topological way. So I'm only going to give you the topological interpretation, and I won't write the differential forms for it.
Does this compactification have to do with allowing instantons to sit on top of each other?
Yes.
That's the physical picture.
Yeah. So here let me do something very, very general. Suppose we have some space X. Well, suppose that X is, for a moment, just compact oriented manifold. Then we can consider the cohomology of X with complex coefficients, and we have Poincaré duality, so we have a map like this. In particular, so here there's a canonical element 1, so we can pair things with 1, and this pairing with 1 gives us some functional, which is, in this particular case, is rather trivial, just integrating over X. And of course it kills all cohomologies except for the top one. But now we're going to consider something slightly more general. So let's, for a second, still keep X to be compact and oriented, but do something slightly different. Namely, I want to consider the covariant cohomology. So suppose that there's some group G acting on X, and this group G can be either compact or a complexification of a compact group. So we have G acts on X. Then we can consider the equivariant cohomology of X with coefficients in G. So this is already unlike the ordinary cohomology, this is already something infinite dimensional, so it leaves basically no cohomological degrees. And it has an important feature that, here there's cohomologies who are just vector spaces, so vector spaces over C. So this is always a module over the equivariant cohomology of a point with respect to G, and this object is known, so this object is always equal to the space of polynomial functions on the Lie algebra of G, which are invariant with respect to adjoint action. So for example, if G is a torus, I prefer to think about, again, in complex language, but this you can also do compact torus. So if this is if G is like this, then let me call this AG. Then AG is just will be polynomials in n variables. Well, I didn't tell you what the grading was, and the grading is that, so this only leaves an even degrees, and so somehow the gradient here, for example, over the degree of each AI will be 2. So this thing is a module over that, and generalizing that construction, you have integration over x, which goes from this equivariant cohomology to this AG. And this is already much less real, because somehow, as I said, here cohomology is infinitely dimensional and leaves basically in infinitely many cohomological degrees. So unlike here, where this thing was non-trivial only on top degree, this is non-trivial in many degrees, also in almost all degrees, in fact. But this is actually not quite what we will need for to write this Nekrasov partition function. What we'll need to write Nekrasov partition function is some slight generalization of this, namely, let's first of all, let's choose maximal torus T in G. I'm sorry? And so let's try to drop the condition X is compact. And actually, for simplicity, this is not necessary, but I will also assume now that X is a complex manifold. So, in fact, just for some formulas that I'll write in a minute, this will be important, otherwise they have to be modified. So I want to drop the condition that X is compact, but something I still want to keep. And what you need to keep is the condition that X, that if you take the fixed point with respect to the torus, you want this to be compact. So require that XT is compact, but don't require that X is compact. Then the claim is that the corresponding integrals are still defined, but they somehow develop sort of singularities. Namely, so the claim is that you still can define integral of x, but it will go from the cohomology of x to something which I'll call kg, and kg is somehow the field of fractions of this. So it means that we consider here, instead of polynomial functions, we consider rational functions. So this is just G invariant rational functions. Come to the algebra. So let me give you an example, which in fact is what Nekrasov is using in his calculation for SLN. So assume that, so we want to require that this is compact, so somehow the easiest compact space is a space which is finite. So assume that XT is finite. Before I do this, so let me say the following thing. So in particular, we can consider integral of 1 over X. And this is now some element in this kg. So, which is basically a rational function. So, for example, if g is a torus, again, this will be some rational function in n variables.
So, this definition is basically the localization formula?
Yes.
So there's no localization theorem. That's the definition of this.
No, I mean, there's no. I didn't give you the thing. I just said that you could define it. I didn't give you the definition.
No, but I'm asking.
No. Of course, the way you give the definition is by means of localization. Localization theorem, yes.
Yeah, but just in this context, it's a definition. There's no other definition that you prove it's equivalent to.
The word theorem or definition is the appropriate word here.
I mean,
in particular case, it's easy to give a definition because this thing is always defined without any conditions on X, just for more or less trivial reasons, if you replace cohomology with compact support. And then somehow, basically, you know, if you think about differential forms, you have differential forms with complex support, so integral is defined. And then you have, of course, a map from cohomology with complex support to ordinary cohomology. And if you localize, if you tensor everything with this, this map becomes an isomorphism under this condition. So therefore, this thing is defined. I mean, if you tensor with kg, then this is the same as cohomology with compact support, so then the integral is always defined just for abstract reasons. And therefore, so let me give you an example. So example, And just let me also note that so far I'm assuming that x was smooth, but in fact somehow in the meantime claiming that everything is defined even if x is not smooth. Or at least one object. So this object will actually be defined always. So example, assume that xt is finite, then there is then actually there is another localization theorem which gives you a formula for this, and the formula is like this. So if I want to integrate 1 over g, then it's going to be sum I'm over x. And actually this is of course a very bad notation, because somehow somewhere in notation I should also introduce the group g, because it's somehow important, but I'm suppressing from the notation. So it's a sum over all fixed points. So first of all, let me write a formula, and then I'll tell you what sense it makes. And here I should write 1 over... okay, so let me write, and then I'll tell you what it means. G... So first of all, there's a standard... So just to tell you what sense it makes, just let me recall that if I really choose a maximal torus, then polynomial functions on G, which are invariant with respect to adjoint actions, are the same as polynomial function on the Lie algebra of a torus, which has invariant with respect to some finite group, namely the Weyl group. So, instead of producing function on the Lie algebra, I can produce a function on the Lie algebra of the torus, which should have some invariance properties. And this is what I'm doing here, namely. So remember, everything, I assume that everything was complex, so all cotangent spaces here understood over complex numbers. And so this is an element, so this G is an element. Well, maybe I should say, you should denote it like that. This is an element in this Lie algebra of the torus. And since this is a fixed point, this Lie algebra acts on the tangent space, so I can take the determinant, and this determinant is a polynomial function on this Lie algebra, then I invert it, and then I sum over all fixed points. And it's easy to see that this is invariant with respect to the Weyl group, so this is in fact an element. And in this case, because I write 1 over this, this is actually a rational function. So, this is a few HA theorem, but this is some kind of well-known theorem. Well, and let me just make another claim that, in fact, the fact that x was smooth is irrelevant. So, in fact, that this integral is defined. There's an actual way how we can define this kind of integral, even if x is so. For any, say, complex algebraic variety, not necessarily non-singular, but with the condition that I raise that the space of fixed points with respect to torus is compact. So, this integral is defined. Not just of one, but any is defined for any x, complex algebraic, so that xt is compact. For example, if you want, I mean, we will only be doing integral of one, and integral of one can be defined in the following way. So you can, if x is single, I can resolve the singularities in a covariant way, and then consider the integral over the resolution, and then it's not difficult to show that the result does not depend on the resolution. So this is one of the ways how we can do this.
What if the fixed point set involves the singularity?
It's okay.
It's still okay?
Yeah. In fact, this will precisely now. I mean, in our case, we'll have only one fixed point, and it will be the most singular point of. Okay, so now I'm ready to write this Nicrossov partition function. So, and in fact, there will be some slight cheating in this definition. So I'll write it, and then I'll mention what this cheating is. But I think that it might only be interesting for mathematicians, not for physicists. So the partition function, well, for some reason, I will want to write here this superscript. Well, okay, no, actually, here I go. So ZG, so this is going to be a function of A lambda epsilon 1, epsilon 2. So here, well, A will be an element in this T. Well, and lambda, epsilon 1, epsilon 2 are just complex numbers. I'll tell you in a second where they come from. So you write a sum of d greater or equal than 0. So here you write lambda to the power d, and here you write integral over this u dg of 1. So let me make several remarks about this formula, about this definition. So the first remark is that, so what are these variables? So as I said, so the group with respect to...
Are there no fixed points at infinity?
What do you mean? There's no infinity.
Huh?
There's no infinity.
In the U, G, D, isn't there some infinity?
What do you mean by? I mean,
well, if you did.
If the thing was compact, then this integral would be automatically zero. So this is, as I said, this is well defined for any x such that the fixed points with respect to torus is a complex space. But then you can easily prove that if x was compact from the very beginning, integral for one will be zero. So the fact that the space is not compact is very important. Of course, the raw fixed point. I mean.
Okay.
But here somehow the group.
Effective answer to my question.
Okay.
Effective
okay. So the group with respect to which we're considering is this group G cross GL2. Now, as I said, so then we're supposed to each one of those integrals should be a rational function. On the Lie algebra, but we can replace it by the Lie algebra of the torus. So this is where this A is coming from. So this thing should actually be invariant with respect to the Wild group. And GL2 also, I mean, the maximal torus in GL2 is, of course, C star cross C star. And so this is where the epsilons are coming from. And this function should also be invariant under interchanging the epsilon.
So you have an inclusion, then you have this new GL2.
Oh, well, sorry, this is not an inclusion. This is an action.
Action. And then,
I don't know how to do it.
Okay, fine. It's an action.
Acts.
And then GL2 comes from where?
GL2 comes just from, this was some modular space of bundles on P2, yes, so yes. GL2 just acts.
So you can be equivariant.
Yeah, so this is taken in the equivariant cohomology with respect to this group, and in the sense that I explained before. So for example, if G is SLN, then what do we get? So what are the variables? So the variables are, so this A becomes a collection of n complex numbers whose sum is equal to zero. So we have this n numbers whose sum. Okay. Now, before I proceed with this, let me make some remarks about this definition. So first of all, the fact that we're considering integral of one here exactly corresponds to the fact that we consider pure gauge theory. So if we consider not pure gauge theory, but gauge theory with some sort of matter, this would correspond to we would have to modify this definition by considering here integrals of some Chern classes of certain natural bundles over the space. Because the space is singular, somehow this it's not mathematically obvious how we define this, but the claim is that we can do this, and somehow, so the main thing is that one should be replaced by some characteristic classes. But unfortunately, somehow my approach to studying this, which I'm going to explain to you, somehow at this moment at least doesn't work for gauge theory with matters, so I can only do this. And another thing is that you can consider, so as I said, I'm doing everything here in equivariant cohomology, but you can consider some other cohomology theories, and this also, as far as I understand, makes some physical meaning. So for example, instead of doing things in cohomology, you can consider the same integrals in K-theory, and they're even much easier to define. And in this case, you somehow... it means that you're speaking not about four-dimensional theory, but about some five-dimensional theory on R4 across a circle. And also you can do things in elliptic cohomology. Then it means that you consider R4 across a two torus. And again, somehow, the approach I'm going to tell you somehow so far is I can't, I mean, in full generality of this, I can't really generalize it to this more general cohomology theory.
With the
K theory, you can't? K theory, I can sort of do two-thirds of it, so I can do about two-thirds of it. So if I mean, there are some technical problems which I can't overcome. There's no natural way to desingularize it for general G. No, what for which particular case? No, for SN, yes, but I haven't said this. So this modulus space of torsion of reduced sheaves exactly gives you a generalization, but for general G, well, something like this, not exactly desingularization, but somehow some sort of explicit description of some other classification exists for I think for all classical groups. But for example, if you want to go to exceptional groups, and there's no explicit way to do something here whatsoever, so somehow. Okay, so let me. It's not known. The conjecture, this Nekrasov's conjecture, which you haven't yet formulated, in this case, is proved. For example,
for every G.
Yes, I mean, as I said, so my approach works in full generality, but only in this particular case when I have just pure gauge theory in R4. So it works.
No, I'm asking to conjectures, not arbitrary pure group.
Yeah, conjecture is the conjecture. Yes, the conjecture is about arbitrary.
So E8, there's a conjecture answer for this?
No, there's no. I think that even for SUN, there's no conjecture answer for this. At least I don't know any. So the only thing which I do know is the following. Well, maybe I should say it's a theorem, because in this particular case it is a theorem. So the theorem is. And when I first look at this, when I first look at this with my mathematical eyes, this looked completely crazy to me, because somehow it's not mathematically it's not really clear what is the meaning of this statement, but somehow it turns out to be true. So this was actually what Nekrasov conjectured. So the conjecture was that, so if you look at this function, so you look at this CG, so first of all, the claim is that it looks like exponential of some function f over epsilon 1, epsilon 2, where this function is, so of course you can write it in this form, but then the statement 1 is that this function is non-singular when epsilon 1, epsilon 2 goes to 0. F is a function of the same variable, so I'm just basically considering logarithm of the z, and I'm just multiplying by epsilon 1, epsilon 2. So the first claim is that the singularity in epsilon is of this form. And then the next thing you want to start is F0, namely, so you want to take this F, and then you want to put this epsilon.
Yeah, means to find a non-singular hypersurface. What do you mean?
No, non-singular, non-singular means that the limit exists. So somehow, the way I understand it, again, mathematically, is that somehow physically, probably originally, what you wanted to define is some kind of partition function without any epsilons. But then somehow you can't do this because the corresponding integrals diverge. And so then, so these epsilons, somehow one way to think about these epsilons is to regularize some integrals, some divergent integrals which appear from the physical problem, but then I want to kill them somehow. And the way you kill them is somehow you do have a singularity. But somehow you consider the most singular term, and this is somehow this is the way you kill somehow these epsilons. And this is I won't have time to tell you exactly what this thing is, but this is something which for physicists I guess is very well known. This is what's called the instanton part of the prepotential, which is constructed there is a fairly explicit formula for this constructing using certain family of algebraic curves. So, for example, if G is SOM, then this is the familiar family, of course, which looks like W plus, I think, I guess lambda squared over W is equal to P of Z, where P of Z is some polynomial. So this is, looks like Z to the N plus some coefficient. Let me write it U 2 Z to the N minus 2, and then all the other coefficients plus U 3 Z to the N minus 3, and so on. So U N, I guess. So it's some family of curves, and then you write some kind of periods for those curves. I mean, if you specify the U's, you get some curve, and then by computing some periods, you can write some kind of function here, which is a function of the U's, and you should think about the U's as invariant polynomials in those A's, which appeared here. And so I don't want to write explicit formula here because I won't have time. So the only thing which is going to be important for me is that
the right hand side of that,
the right hand side. I want to practice.
Here's my question: how is F zero related to that equation?
So F zero is related to that. Okay. So first of all, the U's are invariant polynomials in the A's. So then basically, if I specify the A's, I get some curve. I wrote some algebraic curve. Then somehow this algebraic curve, so now it depends on A's and on lambda. So actually, this thing should be a function of A and lambda. So epsilon's are cubed. So then, I get an algebraic curve which depends on epsilon and lambda, and then I do something with. So I have some specific algebraic curves. In fact, in this particular case, this hyperelliptic curve of genus N, then I do something with periods of this, with some very specific periods of this curve. And so by computing some periods of this curve, I produce a number for each A and lambda. And this is going to be this F0.
So by theorem, you mean that this is now proven for any.
This particular thing is proven for any G. Yes. So if you
for SLN.
No. For EA. So my proof works for any G, but only in this particular case. So if you introduce matter here, then I can.
No. So
this. Sorry. No. No. I said that this kind of curves get only for SLN, but there's a. This is what I was going to say in a minute. So there is a formulation for any G.
For EH, what is the answer?
I can't write you now on the spot as a family of curves, but let me give you some form of the answer. So some form of the answer is this. So somehow, in fact, somehow it's known that what is kind of natural is not really this family of curves, but this family of Jacobians. So if you consider the total space of the family of Jacobians from this curve, then what you get this. Elliptic Toda integrable system, and elliptic Toda integrable system can be associated with any affine Lie algebra. So the answer. Let me just. I can't write the explicit formula, but just let me tell you that the answer is formulated. And in fact, this is what I wanted to say from the very beginning. The answer is formulated in terms of. Similar computations, but for the. Toda, classical Toda integrable system associated. So as I said, this thing can be associated with any affine Lie algebra.
By answer, you mean F naught?
I'm sorry, F naught. Yes. Answer for F naught.
So you're trying to give a characterization of F naught without using curve.
No. I'm trying to using. I want to say something about how this thing is generalized to any G, how this description using curves is, but these curves are known to be spectral curves of this Toda integral system, which affine Toda integral system, which is associated with SLN. And I said this Toda integral system can be associated with any affine Lie algebra, and this thing should be associated with the following affine Lie algebra. So we take our G, we take its affinization, and then. And then we dualize it. And so basically you can associate this Toda integrable system with any affine Dinkin diagram. So if you should first take the affine Dinkin diagram associated with G, and then take the dual affine Dinkin diagram. And I think this kind of answer has already appeared somewhere in physics. I think the fact that it's this kind of dualization, I mean, the first place where I saw this was in some paper of Martinek. I think so. But this really works for any G. I'm sorry?
No, sorry. So
of course this kind of dualization doesn't really, for Islanders, we don't see this dualization actually. Basically the only groups which we see well, for all not simplest groups, you don't see it. But for example, in times B and C, this is really so. Note that this thing. So just remark is that G affine check is not the same as G check affine. So you can't first dualize the root system of G and then take a affinization, get a different affine. And in fact, for example, if you take an entire B, then this thing is not, it's what is called a twisted defined in the algebra, so it's not an affinization of any of the algebra of any finite dimensional of the algebra. All right, somehow, as I said, just look at this. This looked to me very strange. And so, but after you have this formulation for any group, somehow the natural question you can ask is, what is this kind of algebra doing here? I mean, can you somehow see it from the geometry of the problem? So I don't really have much time, maybe 7 minutes. So let me say you very vaguely how this particular statement is proved. So somehow, of course, the most interesting thing here would be to identify this function itself, not just the first term of the asymptotic, but somehow just to say something about this original partition function. And for SLM, there's some kind of combinatorial formula for this Dutton-Nekrasov, which exactly has to do with the fact that our spaces have nice disingularizations. But this formula somehow, and maybe I should say that this was
speak a little more slowly.
I'm sorry. So maybe before I proceed, let me tell you that for G equal to SLM, this was proved before by Nekrasov and Okonkwo. And also by Nakajima, Yoshioka. Now, the method of Nekrasov and Novinko somehow it's based on some very hard calculations. So basically, you write down some explicit combinatorial formula for each. This is after all generating function of some integral. So you write a combinatorial formula for each particular integral, and then do some very hard calculations and somehow prove it in some way which I can't understand really, but this method is somehow quite general. For example, it works for gauge theory with matter. Also, it works if you replace cohomology by K theory. So, in all of these cases, there is a formulation for what this first term of the asymptotic is, and the proof somehow works in all of those cases. And so, this thing I think so far works only in this case. Well, also for pure gauge theory, and also only in cohomology, not in K theory. And as I said, so my proof, which I'm going to mention, somehow works for any G, but somehow again, so far it's limited only to the case of only the case of pure gauge theory. So the interesting thing, as I said, is somehow to really see this affine algebra appearing in this geometry. For example, what I would love to do is to identify this partition function in some terms which are related to this Lie algebra. So far, we have only some kind of complicated statement about the most singular term, but I don't have any statement, any kind of invariant statement about this thing itself. So what I can do though is I can modify this partition function. This is what I'm going to do now, and then I will be able to describe it in full generality without taking any asymptotics. And then there's some kind of easy trick which somehow shows that the asymptotics in these two cases are the same. So somehow, for the purpose of computing F0, what I'm going to do will be somehow enough. So let me just tell you how to modify ZG. And from that, I'm going to write to something which I'll call ZGB. And also here, I want to put the superscript affine. And the reason I want to do this is that you can also erase this and get some different partition function, which is also interesting somehow, which has appeared in other problems, both mathematical and physical. So what is B, first of all? B, again, mathematically, B and G is a Borel subgroup. So So for SLM, this is just a subgroup of upper triangular matrices. So let me tell you what this function is. So the definition will be very similar. So it's again going to be a generating function of integrals of one in the sense of Hecuberean cohomology over some spaces, but the spaces have to be modified slightly. In fact, I should say maybe generalized slightly. So so now I can consider some spaces which I'll denote M, D, theta. So I'll tell you in a second what theta is. GB. And this is going to be the space of, which classifies the following data. So the first part of the data will be the same as before. So this is homomorphic. So let me tell you what the space is in holomorphic language, and then I'll also say what it is in C-infinity language. Holomorphic G-bundle on CP2. Well, the next data is trivialization at infinity in the same sense as before. At CP1 infinity. And the next data is, let me say it in general, then I'll maybe specify what it means for SLM, reduction to B on the horizontal line. So somehow, let me draw the geometry. Suppose that here is our CP2. Now, we have two straight lines here. First of all, there's a line at infinity. So this is CP1 infinite. And also, I somehow choose the coordinate system here and produce the horizontal line. So this is my CP1 horizontal. So here, I want my bundle to be trivialized. And here, if we talk about SLM, and what does mean reduction to B? So it means that if G is SLM, then what do we have? So we have some G, which is just vector bundle of rank M. And here it's trivialized. And what I want here, I just want a complete flag of some bundles here. So if I restrict it to this horizontal line, so this is something of rank N. So I want something. So I want some complete flag of some bundles. So this is the structure, and the structure also these two structures should be compatible in some way. So there should be some compatibility, and the compatibility is sort of natural. Namely, so if you look at this picture, so there's one point where these two lines intersect, and here on the one hand I have trivialization, on the other hand I have a flag. So I want the flag to come from the trivialization. So trivialization means that the fiber at this point is just Cn, and of course the space Cn has a canonical flag. So I want the flag which comes from here to be the one which comes from trivialization. So in fact it's very natural to consider this space, but unfortunately I probably won't have time to explain why this space is so natural. Theta is some discrete parameter. So of course D is the same as before, so G bundle, let me call it G. So I have to tell you what are the parameters. So so D is the same as before the second Schwerin class of G. And theta is another discrete parameter. So so let me tell you first where theta lies. So theta lies in some lattice. So theta lies, so if we choose T and G to be maximal torus, then theta is an element in some lattice lambda, which is the lattice of homomorphisms from C star to T. This is where it canonically lies. In fact, it should also satisfy some positivity condition in the same way as here, this D is actually always non-negative. And the reason, and so the way, somehow, for example, if G, let me tell you where it comes from in the case of SLM. So if G is SLM, then this lambda is just isomorphic to Z to the power n minus 1. And the way you see it here is that here you have the CP1, and on this on the CP1 I have this flag of bundles. You can consider their degrees. And the so if you can see the so this thing automatically has degree zero, so this is easy to see from all our requirements. But you can consider the degrees of all these sub bundles, and you get a bunch of n minus one integers. And and this is where theta lies. In fact, I mean this lambda is an abelian group, but there's some kind of sub semi group of positive elements here, which I won't specify now, but in fact theta will automatically lie here. So somehow I have much more discrete parameters, so now I just set up a new new generating function. I guess I'm already going over time, so give a definition, tell you my main result about this, and I won't even have time for any comments on that. So, the definition is exactly the same, but this will be a function of much more variables. Well, just almost twice as many variables, so I can write x, ax, well, the same epsilon 1, epsilon 2, and lambda. So, before I do this, I need one more thing. So, first of all, there is some kind of analog of Uhlenbeck amplification for this thing, which, again, I don't have time to describe, but there is some way to enlarge this space so that the result is, again, in this particular case, is just an affine algebraic variety of complex numbers. And now, what kind of groups will act here? So, so there will be some similar groups to what we had before, but only I claim that the group T cross C star squared will act on everything. So, in fact, I could replace T by B, but it's not very important for what I'm going to do now. So the reason is that, so before, for example, G acted by means of change in neutralization at infinity. Now the whole of G doesn't act because of this condition that here I need some compatibility. So the only part of G which still acts is the subgroup of G which preserves a given flag, which is exactly this Borel subgroup. But from that I only leave the maximal torus which sits in there because for my topological application, somehow the difference between T and B is not essential. And the same thing with the C star squared, so everything acted, so before I had an action of GL2 which somehow was acting on CP2 and on C2, but now I'm only allowed to act by those elements of GL2 which preserve this horizontal line. And of course, this thing, the C star squared, which sort of acts in vertical and horizontal directions has this property. So I'm only going to consider integrals with respect to this group, and as a result, so they will not be, so before when I considered my integrals, they had some invariance properties, and now these invariance properties will be lost. But other than that, somehow the definition is very similar, so right, just integral over all, sum over all d in theta, so I write lambda to the d, and then I write e to the power x theta, so x therefore, so remember that a lied in my t, and you can easily figure out that x should lie in t dual, and then you write integral of 1 over this u d theta gb. So you get a new partition function which somehow now it has additional x here. Okay, so now let me tell you the final theorem about
it. I forgot what it was before.
Cool.
Factor what?
Which factor? This?
No, that was a 1. That whole thing was a 1 before?
It was a 1, it's still a 1, but somehow the difference is that we have...
But the factor in front, what was it before?
Just lambda. There was no theta and no x, so somehow. So we somehow doubled the number of variables, and this is exactly what somehow I want thesis to explain, what this doubling means physically. But then somehow we can formulate a theorem about this, which describes this thing completely. And in fact, so I will formulate some kind of strange theorem, and I'll just say that this thing is based on differential equation. But in fact, it comes from some explicit description of it using this affinely algebra which I mentioned before. So theorem is that this. Let me first write it in words, and then I'll write the formula for SLN. Is an eigenfunction of something which I'll call of the quantum non-stationary for the operator associated with this G-affine check. So let me write it with eigenvalue scalar product of A with itself. Sorry. So this is actually, so I choose, so I have to choose here an invariant. So we choose an invariant form, bilinear form on the Lie algebra. And of course it reduces to some invariant bilinear form on the Lie algebra of the torus. And this, what is the separator? So the separator looks, so if G is SLN, let me write here an explicit formula. So if G is SLN, then the operator looks like this. So it looks like epsilon 2 times lambda d over d lambda, so this is the non-stationary term, and minus something which is, we forget a factor of 2 somewhere, but I hope it's not very important now. So so here I have to write Laplacian in the variable x multiplied by epsilon 1 squared and minus this total potential term. So I have to write sum I goes from 1 to n minus 1 e to the power xi minus xi plus 1 and minus lambda times e to the power xn minus x1. So these things are in fact simple roots of the affine SLN Lie algebra. And if I do it for general group, then I'll have to write here simple roots of this Lie algebra. So somehow this A enters an eigenvalue, and so all the other variables enter as I have written them, and then somehow there is a next step that which is in fact my joint work with Pavel Eisengoff, where one shows that if you now try to study the singularity of these things as of this eigenfunction as epsilons go to zero, then first of all, we can do it in very general context, basically more or less for any non-stationary operator which looks sort of similar to this and doesn't even have to be integrable. And you can study this asymptotics, and in the most singular term of the asymptotics, this x, this additional variable x, which I have here, will disappear. So so the claim is that first of all, there's a very simple lemma, then that ZG B prime and ZG have the same type of singularity as epsilon 1, epsilon 2 go to 0. Note that here this epsilon already not equal somehow. This thing is not symmetric in the epsilon.
This equation of completely determines
it. Yes.
For example, does it mean that Z depends on A only strictly? The only way A enters.
So
it depends only on the length.
Yes, you're right. Let me see. Did I write this correctly? So, yes,
so is there some A dependence in the equation?
No, I think there should be no A dependence in the equation. So let me see. Probably you're right. Probably it only.
I don't
need other operators. This is the whole point that I don't. I just said no. In this particular context, there are no other operators.
It's still true that this equation alone becomes.
Yeah, no. It determines if this function has a power series expansion as I have written it. Then.
Wait, there's a pre-question to this question. How does A enter into the definition?
In the definition, so in the integral. So these integrals are functions of A. Let me.
Is there an initial condition that depends on A vector itself? In other words, to solve this equation, there's a boundary condition which depends.
No. I think this is right. I think that it just says that the function only.
No, but that's not true.
It's very unlikely. I mean,
that's not true.
But here, I mean, the difference between this, I mean, first of all, there's no this perturbative part of the prepotential is not here. Because as I said, this only corresponds to this instanton part. But let me see. So am I confusing something? No, I think this is.
That would say that SRN and SR2 are not much different.
Okay, sorry.
There's an end there.
I'm sorry?
At the end, he wants to get a function only of a squared, which is very.
You're right. So let me tell you. Okay, so I have to. No, it is definitely an eigenfunction of. All right, in fact, as I said, that this differential equation is a correlative of some.
But you'll think of something good. Why is it working now?
Okay,
great psychology.
All right, so I can't really think. You're right, it shouldn't depend only on the length, but.
So now you've learned not to go into overtime.
Okay. So let me finish what I was going to say. This is really a simple lemma, and then I can show that the thing which actually satisfies this differential equation, which right now to me seems to be correct, has as the first part of its asymptotic has this F zero that was mentioned before. Okay. So.
Questions. Yeah, so
zeta
of z does not depend on x, right?
I'm sorry?
So you're saying that somehow, first you solve this equation and take some limit.
Yes, and then x disappears. X disappears.
No, this exactly.
Oh, I have an idea. Maybe the eigenspace is big.
No, the eigenspace is not.
The A part.
No, the eigenspace is not. No, the eigenspace is one dimensional. That's the whole point. When I say eigenspace, I have to say eigenspace where and what in what space, and so we have in fact you have to work in some specific space of some sort of formal power series, and that space of formal power series, the eigenspace is one dimensional.
Why is it called quantum?
Because of the Laplacian. It's a linear differential operator. It has to do with
is a quantum parameter there for you or not? What is
down?
What's your
idea? In some sense, I can think about epsilon 1 as a quantum parameter.
Yes?
What do you mean?
Explain the
Yeah, I mean, this kind of function can be, in, for example, in all of these gauge theories, which...
Is A related to the X lattice of all the same size? The X lattice, T lattice, same
Torus. Well, you see, for example, I can't write, if you ask about the original partition function without the B, and I can't write it as an eigenfunction of anything. I mean, so I don't really see in what sense. See, somehow, what might be general in some sense, but again, I don't know how general it is that, of course, one would like to say that this partition function has to do with a cylinder, with, you know, R3 cross a circle rather than with R4. And and then if you do work on a cylinder, then maybe there in some kind of generality we'd like to say that it satisfies some kind of equation. And again, somehow in a cylinder you expect to have, you know, kind of you expect the variables to be doubled, and somehow also the one of the variables plays so you write a differential equation in one of the variables and the other plays the role of the eigenvalue. And you know, I don't have any general way to produce such things.
Any other? Okay, let's thank Sasha again.
No, this is okay. I mean, at the moment, I don't see any way why it should.
Could it be that there are different vectors, that there are different?
No, it's just one.
They're different Hamiltonians, no?
No. It's a,